and welcome to the BRC's latest Brexit podcast. Today it's Where Will Brexit End Up? And I'm William Bain, the BRC's Brexit Policy Lead, and I'm joined, as usual, by Aidan Conley, the Director of the Northern Ireland Retail Consortium. Well, today we're going to cover the events in Westminster, in Belfast and in Brussels over the last couple of weeks, a tumultuous fortnight in terms of the Brexit process, and to also answer the really important question, where is this going to end up by the end of March? So I think if we sort of review just what's happened in the last couple of weeks in Parliament, the various amendments which sought to bind the Prime Minister into applying for an extension of the Article 50 process were defeated, namely the binding Cooper Amendment, which would have been followed up by a bill coming to Parliament, which would have given the Prime Minister until the end of February to pass her deal in the House of Commons, failing which she would have been expected to apply to the European Council for an extension of the Article 50 process. Well, that amendment was defeated, as was a similar amendment by Rachel Reeves, but the amendment promoted by Caroline Spelman and Jack Dromey did pass, but that is much less binding in terms of its effect, but 318 MPs voted for that, and that has been seen as an indication that Parliament does not want to see an no-deal outcome. But alongside that, of course, we also saw the passing of the Brady Amendment with a majority of 16 in the House of Commons. And that Brady Amendment, the Prime Minister has taken as a mandate to renegotiate the arrangements within the backstop. The Brady Amendment called for alternative arrangements without quite spelling out what those alternative arrangements mean. And that, alongside the Kit Malthouse Compromise, this attempt to try and perhaps have a transition without a withdrawal agreement, and then also have a sort of pay-as-you-go transition period, these are options as well which the Prime Minister has said should be explored. The civil service is providing assistance for MPs from different parts of the Conservative Party to work these proposals up. Steve Baker, one of the forces behind the Malthouse Compromise, is going to Brussels on the week of February the 11th to speak to Michel Barnier about this. So there's a lot of activity been going on, but I think the key issues and the key feedback we're getting from Brussels is, how does this really take the process forward? It's seen that the Malthouse Compromise has been referred to by many sources in Brussels as the Madhouse Compromise. The sense is that it will not fly in Brussels whatsoever. You can't have a pay-as-you-go transition. You have to sign up for the contract, and the contract comes through the withdrawal agreement. You can't ignore the Irish border and all of the complexities around VAT and excise and SPS checks, as well as the big ticket areas around customs that many MPs have tended to focus their deliberations upon. And so I think ultimately where things appear to be ending up is there'll be a lot of talks going on. Steve Barclay, the Brexit Secretary, will be back in Brussels next week to speak to Michel Barnier and Sabine Vind, the EU's top negotiating team on the Article 50 process. But it's unlikely that we're going to get anything tangible by the end of February. And so I think next week's parliamentary process on St. Valentine's Day is not likely to yield much in terms of fireworks or anything particularly substantial in terms of the final shape of Brexit. I think some of the other things that have been happening this week on the other side of the House in Parliament are really worth considering. So we had this week the letter from Jeremy Corbyn setting out five tests that he would want to see satisfied in terms of any Brexit deal that he could support. And it's interesting the evolution of Mr. Corbyn's customs proposal. Clearly there has been some input from experts and also people in Brussels have talked to them about this. So it's now calling just for a say in future trade agreements that the EU might do with the UK in tandem. That's very different from the position from the autumn, much more, I think, in line with what's doable legally and practically from the European Commission, and also moving a little bit more towards a closer relationship with the single market, not mentioning the exact same benefits from Keir Starmer's six tests, but I think a recognition of moving a bit more towards the Norway plus kind of option, single market and customs union, which some Labour MPs are promoting alongside some soft Brexit Tory MPs as well. So
that some of the political commentators in Northern Ireland here have been asking that if Jeremy's gone from six tests down to five tests, is there room for him to actually get rid of a test a week until we get round to Brexit?
Well, indeed, and we've seen Labour MPs saying that red lines have to disappear in terms of the process of trying to avoid a no-deal Brexit. Lisa Nandy, for example, this week saying that the Labour Party had to be very realistic about its red lines in terms of seeing what might be able to get through and avoid a no-deal outcome. I think the other thing, obviously, that's happening within Labour is that, you know, those MPs are supporting a people's vote, a referendum on the deal with a Remain option being part of that referendum, have been quite upset about this development. But some grassroots people's vote campaigners within Labour have been a bit more sanguine about this process. And I think this is a reflection of the fact that the PM's got a real balance. She's like sort of pitched on a seesaw. If she moves too much in the direction favoured by the ERG, then she loses the possibility of any Labour votes necessary to deliver a stable majority for any deal. And if she pivots too far in the direction of the kind of soft Brexit Labour MPs, she loses Tory MPs from the other part of the seesaw. So it's a very difficult balance. And this will continue, I think, throughout February. But it's really only, I think, now into March, maybe even as late as a possible European Council on the 21st of March, that the PM is going to have to resolve this. And Brussels is looking for a stable majority, not just a sort of one-off vote as we saw for the Brady Amendment, but a stable majority that would get through a meaningful vote process, Mark 2, and also, very importantly, deliver the transition through the withdrawal agreement bill that would have to go through full processes in the Commons and the Lords. And I think, how does Brussels see this process as working? Well, the parts of the deal which could be finessed are in relation to the political declaration. That's the politically binding but not legally binding signpost of the future relationship between the UK and the EU. So I think we could expect to see some of the sort of references that Steve Baker and the Malthouse team have been looking at, maybe specifying the kind of technological processes which could be used to try and facilitate a soft Irish border. And I think also we would expect to see a sort of pivot in that document to spelling out how any future customs relationship could build upon the single customs territory, which is the UK-wide customs union part of the backstop, the Irish protocol within the withdrawal agreement. So I think we will end up with a withdrawal agreement that is untouched. There'll be a political declaration which will reflect some of these emerging views in the House of Commons to try and get to a stable majority, give people a reason to vote for that withdrawal agreement. And there may well be a joint interpretative instrument, a kind of side legal note that clarifies that the backstop is intended to be temporary. The legal basis, indeed, for the backstop is that it is temporary, but without having a legal cut-off date. That's very, very important for Dublin. As people have said over the last week or so, some really strong commentary from Simon Coveney, the Tánaiste, and from other senior politicians like former Taoiseach Bertie Ahern, you can't put a timescale on peace. And so I think that's been a really important element. So I think February is all about the preparation for the big month, which is March. And I would say expect a resolution very late in the day. This is going to go down to the wire and people are going to have to look into their souls in Parliament and see what is it they want to avoid. Can they accept a second choice whilst maybe not getting their first choice? And that, I think, is going to be central to whether a deal is possible, whether the withdrawal agreement enters into force and whether we can move on to the next stage of the negotiations and avert the cliff edge on March the 29th. So just a quick summary in terms of sort of Brussels and London. To move over to Belfast and Dublin more specifically, Aidan, I think you've had some really strong and impressive meetings the last couple of weeks. What is your sense of where opinion is on the Irish protocol?
I think we're a little bit more sanguine here in Northern Ireland, quite simply because we are used to going to the wire with all of our negotiations, and we go through negotiations pretty much every year. I think, though, what they from Dublin, we're getting the very, very strong vibe that they're not for backing down. The meeting with the Department of Foreign Affairs, Department of the Taoiseach, and they were quite clear that they had Europe behind them. They were quite clear that they weren't for budging, and they were quite clear that this the withdrawal agreement as is, and the backstop especially, protected the island of Ireland, and that they could not see any substantive changes being made to it. On the other side of things, they were quite willing to have conversations. You know, things were bandied about as far as political declaration 2, or even political declaration 3. The thing is, unless we have movement from those in Parliament, and especially from the DUP and the ERG, then, you know what, another political declaration is not going to move us any further forward. And this week, I met with the Prime Minister. I also got 2 off my bucket list for the media. Not only was I talking to Faisal Islam on Sky News, but I also managed to get on to Al Jazeera, who knew even knew that we existed here. As far as our meeting with the Prime Minister, a lot of it was in full reassurance mode. She was trying to give us the reassurance, especially those business groups who had come out in favour of her deal or who had been supportive of her efforts, that could have felt betrayed, as the Belfast Telegraph put it. We didn't actually feel that way. We were looking for clarity, and she was there to provide us with a level of clarity that she could, and also give us the reassurances. We're quite aware that there are bigger political games here in play, and I think that both the BRC and the NARC have been quite unanimous in coming out and saying that the time for political games and brinkmanship has long passed. However, that's the position that the Prime Minister finds herself in. She mentioned MaxFac again, and we made it clear that it doesn't deal with the huge problem that we would have with SPS and agri-food and regulatory checks. And we basically told her that it was another unicorn, and that it was not a credible answer. And to be honest, it was a huge distraction at the moment. The PM understood our need for frictionless trade, but also said there had to be a balance between checks and alignment needs, and she feels that part of that is in the UK, or the EU's ball court at the minute. She's encouraging us to meet with the Malthouse Group. We have actually written to the Malthouse Group, and we're talking to them to try and see when we can meet up. It's important for them to understand what their proposals or what their alternative arrangements, whatever they may be, what effect those would have on both the economic and the social side here in Northern Ireland. She wanted us particularly to be vocal. The Prime Minister was very keen to hear about what we were saying, that the Northern Ireland problem is not just a problem for Northern Ireland. So with the amount of food that we, our members buy in Northern Ireland that actually goes through the Republic of Ireland, Dublin to Holyhead, for those just-in-time deliveries, also the amount of food that is bought from the Republic of Ireland that goes to Great Britain, if the Irish border problem is not solved in a very frictionless way, in a way that allows trade to happen almost as it is now, then what you're talking about is that right from Belfast to the Prime Minister's own constituency of Maidenhead, there will be availability issues, there will be cost issues, and those will be felt right across the UK. So it's imperative when we're looking at the integrated supply chains that we have across these islands that we realise that this Northern Ireland issue is not just about Northern Ireland. She was quite clear that this was the start of a conversation. She was quite thankful for the work that we'd been doing to try and make the tangibility of a no deal, what it actually means for our consumers, for our shoppers, clear to the body politic. In summary, very good meeting in as far as commitments, very good meeting as far as sentiment. A bit lighter on plan than we would have liked.
That's great, Aidan. And I know you've got some really big meetings coming up in Dublin in the next couple of weeks as well. So it shows the BRC, the NIRC, working really hard at the very highest levels to get members' messages across and to influence what happens in terms of these negotiations. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the key issues which Michelle Barnier and Sabina Vyand have made clear is this is not just an Irish issue. And where every time you go to Brussels and you speak with MEPs from right across the EU, right across the full range of political parties, you get this sense this is an existential issue about the single market and the customs union. You cannot have a sort of 500-kilometre soft exit point into the customs union and the single market where there are unregulated goods from outside the EU entering the single market, and it's about consumer protection within that single market area. And that's why this idea about sort of max fac and putting scales under the roads, we've heard, was one of the options that government were considering, weighing vehicles as they crossed the border. It doesn't deal, as you said, Aidan, with this fundamental issue about checking meat and milk and yogurt and Bailey's Irish Cream and fish and all of the products which would have to undergo at least spot checks for SPS.
You're just reading off my shopping list.
Exactly. Yeah, but that's your weekly shop, Aidan. That's great. Good luck in finding that tonight. All of these practical issues that a lot of the people who are in the Westminster bubble, sadly, never really engage with. And I think the other thing that comes through when you talk to politicians and officials in Brussels, and I think this message is starting to get through in Westminster as well, is the sense that the Irish border is a particular kind of border issue. It's not the same as Sweden, Norway, or Germany, Switzerland. There is a history which is there, and that was reflected in the joint report, let's not forget, because in December 2017, the UK and the EU committed to no border infrastructure whatsoever. So that means cameras, it means mobile vans, it means putting scales under the roads. I mean, I didn't even know that was a thing, but apparently a company believed that it is.
At this point, it might be good to point out that whether or not the EU has the good intentions of not having infrastructure, or the UK has the good intentions not to have infrastructure on the Irish border, the fact is, to protect consumers, to protect the single markets of both the UK and the EU, and actually this existential nature of the customs union and the single market within the EU, one or other of them will have to put up a border to make sure that those markets are secure.
Yep, yeah, I mean, that's entirely clear from current EU law, and there's no prospect that that's going to change anytime soon. These are the sort of founding tenets upon which the customs union and the single market are built. So I think it's been a really eventful fortnight. The other thing I think is important to flag up is the continuing process around the trade deal rollover. Remember that if the UK does exit without a deal on the 29th of March, it falls out not just of the customs union, the single market, it falls out of nearly 40 trade deals with third countries, 75 third countries around the world. And this week, of course, we discovered that some of these agreements simply will not be in a position to be rolled over in time for 29th of March exit day. So really important trade deals with Turkey that a lot of BRC members will be importing clothes from, tariff-free. No rollover of that means average tariff on clothing imports from Turkey, 12%, big increase in import costs. The agreement with Japan will not be in a position to be rolled over either. Moldova, Algeria. So this is a big concern, I think, to members, that there'll be lots of hidden costs, hidden tariffs, hidden loss of trade facilitation measures, which will increase the cost of getting goods into the UK, and ultimately these costs would have to be passed on to consumers. So this is a really important thing for the BRC. We've been lobbying very hard to make sure that the government gets the message. But again, I think this is increasingly just one of many issues where, frankly, in terms of a no-deal scenario, which we want to avoid strongly, it just increasingly looks as if the UK is not going to be ready for that in any kind of shape for March the 29th. And also, I think the other thing that's come out in the last couple of weeks, we talked earlier about the need for a withdrawal agreement bill to enact the transition, put in place the citizens' rights provisions, and also the new financial procedure for the $35 billion financial payments under the withdrawal agreement. There's also the trade bill, which would have to get through as well. And of course, there could be a customs union amendment just waiting in the House of Lords or in the House of Commons, indeed, on that. So these important measures would be needed even to deliver Brexit with a deal. So again, I think one of the things we perhaps can expect at some point in March is for some form of request for a technical extension of around 2 to 3 months in order to deliver any kind of Brexit. But I think the key message is February, it's all about the talks behind the scenes, and we wouldn't expect any action of that front in the month of February. Well, I think we've covered all of the developments in the last couple of weeks. As ever, do keep your questions and comments coming in to us here at the BRC. Also, any sort of advice which people are looking for, we're here to address that. And from myself and from Aidan, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me.